Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. This week we're joined by Andrew Godwin to talk about all things Django. I'm Will Vincent, joined as always by Carlton. Hey, Carlton.
Hello there. Hello, Will.
And hi, Andrew.
Hello. Good to meet you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on. This is really exciting because you've been responsible for many cool things in Django in the past and are currently working on really the future of Django. So lots to cover around async and all the rest that you've done. So maybe let's start off with, can you quickly give us your background on how you got into coding and Django in particular?
I can, yeah. So like my first foray into coding was a little bit unusual. I started programming on a Palm PDA, a Palm 5 to be precise. There was basically like this little sort of basic app where you could like write basic programs and do little games. And like that's where I cut my teeth coding. So that, you know, and I was one of those like annoying like early teenage coders because of this. I was like 14, 15 on holiday with my parents in Cornwall, just coding in the caravan rather than actually like doing any outdoor holiday things.
But then I'm not going outside.
Yeah, exactly. Like also it's Cornwall in summer. It's never that. It's sometimes nice. It's a beautiful place when it's sunny, but there's a lot of rain too. But then I took from that, went to some PHP. So did a lot of PHP when I was sort of starting university, that kind of stuff. And then I think it was about 2006, I went to work for a company called Torchbox, who are an agency in Oxfordshire. And that's where I met Simon Willison. And Simon Willison, if you ever met him, is an amazingly enthusiastic person. And he, within, I think, 2 weeks, had taken me from writing PHP to writing Django, which, of course, was very young at the time. It was pre-version 1.0. And so that's kind of my route into Django. And then I've sort of worked with Django ever since, I'd say, at that point. But on and off, like, so Torchbox also where I wrote the first version of South. And so it's also my, yep. You know, I think 2 summers later, because I was doing summers there during university. So I'd do university during term time, come the summer break, I would then go and work at Torchbox for a few months. And I basically sort of released South, and this was back when like Russell was still doing Django Evolution. There was still like lots of options for migration frameworks in Django. And I got this email from Jacob, who I'd never met and like vaguely heard of at this point. Jacob Kaplan-Moss, that is. He's like, Andrew, like, oh, we've seen your release. We're having a panel at DjangoCon, the first DjangoCon in Silicon Valley. Would you like to go? And I was like, well, I'm just a student. I don't have the money to fly to America, which I've never been to. And he's just like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, no, the DSF will cover it. Like we'll pay for you and give you a scholarship to come out there. So like, and this is like maybe 3 or 4 weeks until the conference. So at four right. weeks' notice, I basically go, okay, and then book a ticket to America, which I've never been to, fly out to Silicon Valley in like maybe the most alienating thing. But then I found this wonderful community of people who are so supportive. And that, even that first DjangoCon, I think, like settled me into Django properly.
And that's really interesting that even at that early stage, the DSF still already existed and they were already, you know, sponsoring students to come to conferences. And
I'm not sure if it's... my memory does not serve me well. It may not be in the DSF in its current form, but like some version right. of something. Like Jacob was like, yes, we can cover the costs for you, basically. And that's what got me out there.
Right. Fantastic. So that's super. And then that we heard tell that there was some kind of celebrity deathmatch panel about migration frameworks.
Yes, I think it was me, Simon, and Russell Keith McGee on stage doing this. And like, so I forget what Simon's one was called, but so Simon had one that was MySQL only. Russell had the rather excellent Django Evolution, and I had South. And sort of this like, we did a little presentation, we did a little chat. But like through the years that followed, South slowly became more and more dominant until eventually it sort of morphed into the rewrite that became Django migrations that are now built in.
So currently you're at Eventbrite.
Yes.
What led you to there? Has it all been Django, or like many developers, have you done non-Django things at various companies along the way?
Yeah, it's pretty much all been Django. So like after university, I worked Torchbox for a year or so. I went and did some freelance work and worked with a few different companies like Global Radio, who used to be running Django, that kind of thing, and a few other small companies. And then eventually I settled into doing some contracting for Lanyard, which was a sort of a site for discovering professional events was the idea. So like, you know, here are all the conferences and you can follow your friends. And that was run again by Simon Willison. So like my career and Simon's touch points along a lot of points along the history.
And you just sort of follow him along, really?
Well, not quite, but I've worked with him on and off for like 13, 14 years now. And then, like, you know, I enjoyed contracting at Lanyard. Eventually Simon offered me short divert here. Just before this, I had applied for a job at the British Antarctic Survey to be the on-site sysadmin at one of the bases in the South Pole. Not South Pole, but cool. In Antarctica, Halley 6. And unfortunately, that was the year that the BBC documentary series Frozen Planet had aired. And so the number of applications for that position went from 2 to about 40. And I got this very apologetic call from the wonderful people at the Antarctic Survey going, it's such an unusually good year. And like any other year, we would have hired you, but there was somebody who was just more experienced than you, and we went for him instead. And so Simon very nicely waited a week and then offered me a full-time role at Lanyard after I missed out on my Antarctic base position. But then...
So suits... Suitable grieving period.
Well, not quite, week. But I was very fond of, I still am fond of the idea. Like, if I get a chance, I'm going down to Antarctica. But it's not easy to do, as you can imagine. But then shortly afterwards, like, I started working for Lanyard. And then in 2012, 2013, something like that, Lanyard got acquired by Eventbrite, and I've been Eventbrite ever since.
Right, okay. And you're still there. And so, I mean, and this leads into your kind of work on channels and the async stuff, because you would do a lot of the related to the work you do at Eventbrite. I don't know how much you can say about that. But can you sort of talk about the evolution of the async thoughts and the thoughts around channels and
yeah, for sure.
Things like that.
As one of the interesting things is like Eventbrite has a lot of interesting challenges of Django at scale. Like these days, especially, like it's just grown and grown over the last 5 or 6 years. But interestingly, very little of that is async. A lot of my work that is based on like seeing the challenges Eventbrite faces and like how would we tackle them? Like what is the best approach? And so some of those ideas we have tried internally at Eventbrite. Some of those ideas are more like they doing things in a large company is different to doing them on a volunteer project. So they're better done on Django and then maybe brought in later in the future. But a lot of those do stem from like, you know, Eventbrite has a slightly unique traffic pattern in that it deliberately DDoS ourselves like multiple times a day, because our model is we have these things that go on sale and everyone arrives at once for that event. Like in e-commerce, like normally e-commerce is like, oh, Christmas is terrible, or like Thanksgiving or Black Friday, but everything else is quiet. Whereas we just have like this very like gentle demand curve and then these massive spikes like a few times a day as events sort of go on sale. And so that's an interesting scaling challenge that some of the things in async are particularly good at coping with.
So yeah, sort of like Black Friday a couple times every day.
Right, exactly. But much, much shorter and sharper, and you get 20 seconds warning, which is always fun.
So we had Simon on just a little while ago to talk a little bit about some of these things, and he mentioned how global Eventbrite is. So is that sort of a continuous throughout the day thing then, where like Europe to America and Asia, or is it, does it matter sort of the geographic range of where those spikes are, or it's...
I mean, yeah, like as we get more global, it's the spikes spread out over the time zones, as you can imagine. But there is, you know, Eventbrite's still very heavily in Europe and America, so that's where they tend to congregate. But yeah, like it has started being like, well, they happen at 3 a.m. Pacific time too, right? And like nobody in the SF office is awake at that point, but we have a wonderful Madrid office now. Madrid might be around. Like it's trying to like make sure that you have global coverage, but also you have to just start to code to cope with those things at some point, right? Like you can't treat everyone specially. Like, well, we just have to design for this. We have to expect it. And we can't design for it by over-provisioning the entire site so that it runs at full capacity all the time and just waste money. So there's an interesting balance there that async really helps enable.
But there's interesting questions, I guess, as well, about how fast you can spin up instances and how, you know, what kind of lead time. You know there's a spike coming, so you can spin up instances in advance. But then there's coordination issues. So you must be using Kubernetes and have problems with ingress tables and
We have a very curious... I can't talk too much about the actual infrastructure stack. Like, I do work on that. Yeah. I'm an SRE. I sort of, like, do SRE architecture over there these days. A lot of the, like, spinning up servers on demand is a difficult proposition. Especially, so, like, our Django app... It's in or near the million lines of code mark. It takes 30 seconds to import all the Python modules into memory. Like there's just so many Python modules that just the import itself is slow. And so like we even have that like cold boot problem of like, well, it's a big app, spinning it up takes a lot of time. And we're trying to break it up and make it into smaller pieces, but it takes time to turn a monolith into services.
Right. Okay. And I don't know if this is something you've come across or whatever, but I saw on the Sentry blog that they were talking about you rewriting little elements in Rust or something like that to get speed gains there. Is that something you might do as well?
I mean, honestly, is it... rewriting it in Python has kind of been our strategy. Like Eventbrite's still a very heavily Python company. Right. And pretty much, like, the one case where we needed to speed up, like PyPy, as in PyPy, gave us that speed up, right? Like, it cost a bit more RAM, but, like, it made our webhooks delivery, like, 7 times faster, I think. And so there are places, like, if you need that trade-off, you can still do it within the Python ecosystem. I think there is one piece written in Go, but that's because it was a time before async HTTP in Python was ready. Like, so like, we have like a live seat map viewer where you can see, like, here's the seat map at the venue, and the seats, like, vanish in real time as people pick them. So the whole thing is, like, live streamed. And that was written sort of 4 or 5 years ago, before WebSockets and Python and async HTTP was a good thing. And so that's all that particular bit is written in Go.
So let's talk about channels, because I think a lot of this is, as a Django educator, I get a ton of questions about this because it seems sort of like sexy in the future of Django, but I think most people don't really understand what it is, actually. I'm curious, could you give the backstory of channels and kind of how that's morphed over time to where we are today?
Yeah. So, and channels history actually starts away from me. It starts with Aymeric Augustin, one of the Django contributors. And he is responsible for things like the big transaction rewrite, for example. And Aymeric did a lot of work quite a few years ago now on an attempt at doing WebSockets with Django. He has sort of a game of life example where every cell ran its own socket and that kind of thing. And I looked at that and I talked to him a few times and I was interested. And also at this point, like, migrations was done. I'd had a year or two clear of it. So I sort of understood, like, I'd recovered a bit from the burnout that comes with pushing yourself on migrations, as you can imagine. And then I was like, okay, well, I want a new project. What seems to be the best thing to do for Django? Like, what is Django's future? And at that point, WebSockets was the new kid on the block. It seemed to be the thing everyone wanted. And so I was like, well, okay, like, let's take a serious look at this. And of course, as I did with South, I was like, well, South succeeded by being a external project, integrating into Django, and then over time becoming very popular and eventually being merged in. So, like, well, let's follow the same principle, right? And so I was like, okay, so Channels is going to try and be this separate sort of third-party app, except we're going to sort of fund it under the DSF's auspices. So the wonderful folks at Mozilla gave us a grant for, I think, $115,000 or thereabouts to fund it for a year or so, or year or two, in fact, ended up being. And so, like, that helped build it out and helped have the research. And a lot of what Channels is basically, like, how do you take a synchronous Django and not touch it, but somehow wrap asynchronous around it, so particularly for WebSockets especially. It doesn't really try and address asynchronous HTTP. It's in there. Like, you can do it, but it's not easy. It's not really designed for that. It's much more about, you want either normal, boring, synchronous HTTP with Django, or you want flashy WebSockets with channels. But there's very little middle ground between those two.
Yeah, and I know, I think it was at Django Under the Hood, you gave, like, a 50-minute talk where you really went into the details on all this that we can... Do I have that right? It was a Django Under the Hood?
Yes, no. The Django Under the Hood was almost certainly where it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we can link to that so you don't have to repeat that. So I want to talk more about that, but actually it brings up, can you talk about, so merging South into Django, what was that like? Because from the outside, I started with Django when South was there, and then just kind of magically it happened. But what was that process like for you personally and just the logistics of the Django community? Because that is one of the largest, you know, third-party packages coming into Django. And many third-party ones, you know, Django REST Framework don't and probably won't. So curious, what was that experience like? Because I'm sure it was a ton of work and work in ways that aren't obvious from the outside.
Yeah. One of the things I think that's not immediately obvious to some people is that it wasn't moving South into Django. It was a full rewrite. So, like, Django Migrations is a from-scratch rewrite of South. Basically, I took the... I think 6 or 7 years at that point of lessons from maintaining a migration framework and going, okay, like, if I could do it differently, here is what I would do. And this is the one chance we get to have breaking backwards compatibility, right? So, like, we're going to provide a migration path, but that migration path is going to be, like, not particularly fluid. Like, you have to, like, basically move to migrations and then run a command to synchronize it all up and you're done. And so, like, that, basically, I sat down, I planned it all out, I went to Kickstarter, We ran it as a Kickstarter, and I think I raised like £17,000, I think, something like that. And that helped, again, fund it. So like a lot of, one of the things I do is I work 4 days a week, and the fifth day each week is for open source work, which is, I'm very thankful I've had from Lanyard, I've had from Eventbrite. Like, they've been very supportive in both of these. And so like that money basically pays for my fifth day a week to work on the projects. And so with migrations, when I was back at Lanyard, I believe this was, I was doing that, and I was like, okay, let's, you know, raise the money so I can fund it and take the salary cut and it makes sense. And then I sat down, planned it out, went to the community and said, here's my pitch. Like, this is before the DEP process. So like, we didn't have a DEP. So I was like, I just pitched on Django developers, and I pitched like the core team at that point. It was like, okay, like, this seems like what we want. Does anyone disagree? And I got very little pushback. I think the one pushback was like, I have problems with South. I was like, yes, I do too. Here is the list of problems. Here is how we're going to fix them. And I think, and everyone agreed that like, it's a problem that pretty much every install of Django faces, right? Like almost everyone has that problem with the ORM. And so that all lined up. And then I just sat down, spent 6 months to a year doing the full rewrite, fully testing it, and then released it in Django 1.7. And then a few extra fixes. And then I'm very thankful to people like Marcus and other people who took over maintenance of it, like after I'd sort of done that and burnt out a bit. But yeah, it was an interesting time.
I remember migrating projects. It was, you know, it was like, we've got to change, and we've got it, but it was remarkably smooth in the end. Like, you know, looking back, you think, oh, it wasn't that bad, you know, and at the time you're pulling your hair out, but it was well done. I remember, you know, it was one of the big milestones in Django's move from the early days to the later days, I guess, when the 1.7 with the migrations coming in.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what was that collaboration like? I mean, so was it 6 months you just went off and did on your own? Like, how often were you showing the work to others? Like, how did that, like, so how would it be different now with async stuff versus what you did back then?
So yeah, so back then it was very much I became a hermit, right? Like I got approval. I went into the shadows for 6 months and came back with basically a beta version.
Like, here you go, you're welcome.
Yeah, no, like, I wouldn't recommend this, right? It's not a good strategy, but it's also, like, as a developer, it's my default, and it's hard to get away from that. And so, like,
some degree of space is nice, too. I mean, you can't have people second-guessing you as much as you're second-guessing yourself with some decisions.
Oh, totally. But at the same time, like, having people to bounce off of is also crucial to, like, getting good development done, right? And one of the things I've learned at Eventbrite is, like, how to run large projects. And so, like, if you look at the async proposal versus, like, the migrations proposal, if you could go back and look at it, they're structured very differently. Like, async is structured in a way where it's like, well, this is a very big project. It needs to be across multiple people. It needs to provide value in incremental steps and not be one big dump. And it needs to be like exchangeable between like different people and like we can pull out any time. Like that's kind of like, it's run like how I'd run things as a lead engineer at Eventbrite. It's run in that way. If like,
yeah,
we have to have this be small incremental steps that are all achievable by themselves rather than Andrew goes into a bunker for a year and writes it.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, we'll obviously link to it. It's a lengthy document, but I was struck when I read it that it was how iterative it was. I mean, I was quite impressed because I know it's very difficult to not just have the idea, but to have the roadmap. And yeah, I guess that makes sense that doing that professionally guides the process of then doing it in an open source way.
Yeah, and it's one of the places where like open source and commercial work often reflect off each other. Like I've taken things from open source, like documentation culture, into Eventbrite, and that's really helped. And Simon has too, right? Like there are things that go both ways. And like running large projects is not a thing you see a lot in open source. And I am determined to not have this be a burnout center again, right? Like that I've learned from the last two times, I would hope. And like even if we just do the first part, it's a win, right? Even if we just...
No, but that's...
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Even if it's just the view layer that gets, you know, that gets async, that's kind of okay. It'd be nice if we get to the ORM and we get all that. But if we have the view layer, then we can write proper async apps and we can embed other ASGI apps and we can do all sorts of really exciting things with just that. And
right. And I think of like having an async view and routing and URL layer opens the door to everything else, right? Like once you've opened that door and you can do async def views, then like the community can fill in things. Like if you want to do an ORM, you can, but maybe you can pull in like Tom Christie's databases library and do async stuff with that, right? You have all these different options. Yeah. And so that really, to me, is the way of doing this, of like, let's get that first thing unlocked. And like that first piece of work is arguably the most like solo piece of work. Like I don't intend for it to be done by me alone. I want to try and get some collaboration, but it needs to be tightly controlled. It needs to be like have high, like, I'm not saying the word high touch, but like lots of contact between different people who are working on it and make sure it's a singular vision so that it comes out right. Everything else can be like, you know, like async forms, async ORM, async cache can be farmed out to different teams. That's going to work fine. And hopefully to new contributors as well. Like I'd love to be like, hey, like we need the cache layer to be async. We can write you a clear definition. We can give you some guidance and mentorship. Let's bring on some new contributors to Django as part of that process.
I think as well, the view layer needs to, in a way, it's going to be less susceptible to changes going forward. So it kind of almost has to be right or nearly right first time. It, you know, if we mess up the form layer, well, we can redo the form layer. We could have, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But the view layer would be annoying to have to introduce breaking changes later on.
And I think it's notable too that like one of the fun things about going through and doing some of this first parts of the work and some of the research is you run git blame on some of these view code files. It goes back a decade, right? You immediately jump to like 3.1.0. Like most of the rest of, like, you know, I remember when the current form system was called new forms, right? Like most of the rest of Django has changed over that time. And the view layer has mostly stayed the same. Like one of the things people don't realize is that Django predates WSGI. Like WSGI basically came around kind of from like Django and Turbo Gears and other contemporary frameworks. And so like in some ways, Django doesn't have Django is not WSGI all the way through because it predates it. Like you go look at like Flask and Verkzeug, like they are basically written around WSGI. I've talked to the Flask maintainers and like David Lord about like what it would take for him to support async. And he's like, well, like it's so deeply ingrained in our stack that it's a lot harder to untwist, and it's possible we can swap some ideas. But whereas Django, like we have that distance, which means that both it's very old code, but at the same time, it's kind of not totally tied to WSGI.
Simon talked a little bit briefly about that abstraction when, creating Django. And that's great that's a major strength today, that abstraction. I sort of wonder how Flask will handle that.
Yeah, it's not really a strength. It's an accidental helpful thing, right? That we get the place.
Yeah, okay. Strength is the wrong word.
It's us not touching for 10 years, maybe not a strength. But again, a testament to the original developers, it's run fine for a decade, right? But I want to touch it once. Crucially, I want to keep the same kind of abstraction because like I think one of the things that appeals to people like Django the most is like that very simple like mapping of like, hey, you have a function or a class, you put it in a URLs file, bam, it's done. There's no like weird routing, there's no magic objects, there's no like tracing attributes or like implicitness. Like it's very explicit, and I want to try and keep that design.
So you talked about the experimental work that's gone in thus far, and so the ASCII ref, the ASCII standard is just gone to its 3.0 version, or it's version 3. And so can you talk just quickly about the ASCII standard, and is that kind of stable now? Is 3 going to be around with us for a long time?
Yeah, so my impression is that 3 is very stable. So in many ways, ASCII was one of the goals of the Channels project, which was to, like, Channels was both trying to make WebSockets work, but also research into what it means to make an asynchronous Django. Like, Channels was always meant to be the predecessor to Django itself becoming async. But when I started that project, I had no idea what that would look like. And we also didn't realize WebSockets wouldn't be nearly as popular as we thought they would be, right? Like these days, it's like, nah, like HTTP 2 has made like AJAX a lot more reasonable, and like long polling is still around, and sockets are they're still used, but they're not as popular as maybe, they're not, like every site's not using them. And so ASCII 1 was this sort of weird internal channels format. ASCII 2 was born out of the Channels 2 rewrite, which we'll maybe go into in a little bit. It was basically sort of like a better version. And then Tom Christie has been instrumental in ASCII 3 of like running a full ASCII framework and using it in production and having channels used in production and talking to other frameworks. So like, you know, like we've had weigh-in from a decent number of Python web frameworks on ASCII 3 to try and make it something that both seems implementable by servers. Like I've talked to a few different server authors too. They're like, this seems okay. Like no one says it's good because no one wants to write new server support. But like people generally seem like, it seems fine. And web frameworks agree this too. And crucially, ASCII 3 is the most looking like WSGI yet, which I think was always the goal. Like it's meant to be a spiritual successor, but not a direct successor.
Tom Christie gave a great, I don't know if it's keynote, but talk at DjangoCon Europe this year about async and ASCII that we'll link to for people who want to get up to speed on the terms we're tossing around.
Yeah, that talk is also a fantastic dive into his vision for a totally un-Django-like but very pure ASGI framework, which is fascinating.
What came for me out of the DjangoCon thing was that the people were talking, well, why do we need async? Why, you know, what is this? Well, you know, what came from Tom's talk was very clearly that, well, we don't want to have to change language just because we need that extra throughput that async will give us. And so Python's got to have async, and ASGI's a great candidate for a Python standard for web frameworks there. And then, well, why does Django have to have it? Well, because Django's the batteries included web framework in Python. And so it may not be that we need everything that ASGI could offer, but we need something. You know, you don't want to have to change web framework just because you want to build async views. And so I think it's really important. That was kind of interesting from the conversations at DjangoCon around that.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic strength of Django, too, that it's so mature that it can be this forward-looking. It's not just constantly triaging past bugs. You know, it takes up 100% of the bandwidth of the fellows and the core contributors.
Yeah. I think one of the things that batteries included is that, like, some batteries are very easy and some batteries are very hard. Like, migrations is a very hard problem, and I think async ranks the same category. Like, it's a thing that we should solve so everyone else doesn't have to. Like, and that, like, anything security related or like networking related, I think falls in this category. Like, Django, like, you know, for example, doesn't provide things like, you know, nice looking UI libraries because it's better solved by other people. But like, solving async is a thing that like Django kind of should treat as its core competency, right? Like, it has to be baked in.
Well, the security is a good analogy, because I was just I'm writing a book on Django, which hopefully will be out by the time this comes out, and in the security chapter, basically it's you know, you can take off the defaults that Django provides, but think pretty carefully about doing that, because it just gives you the guardrails, and it does give you the option to take them off if you want to write raw SQL, or, you know, but if you don't want to have CSRF tags, but it just sort of handles it for you, right? Because security, yeah, is also that, oh my God, it's such a deep well of knowledge. And once you get beyond the sort of basic attacks, it's almost kind of infinite. And that's the point of these, the monthly updates to Django and all the work. So yeah, so one of these areas that's definitely, if someone else can handle it for the community, or the community, a small subset of the community can handle it for Django developers, it's a huge benefit and doesn't need to be redone each time.
Yeah, and you touched on a thing there too, which I think is important to Django, which is that, like, you can remove pieces of it, right? You can remove the guardrails. Like, some web frameworks don't have that, right? Some web frameworks are all or nothing. I think famously, like I don't wish to talk bad about Rails, but my experience working on Rails projects was like Rails
That's
was
what
all
I was
or
thinking
nothing.
Of, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, I spent a good 6 months working on Rails projects, and it was very informative. But whereas,
well, yeah, but it's I mean, yeah, that's what I get that question a lot of. Well, should I use Rails? Should I use Django? And I, you know, specifically for a beginner, the user authentication in Django is more work than Rails.
Yeah.
Because Django then makes it completely customizable and you can swap out what you want, but it comes at the cost of more upfront time. And so that's kind of what I tell people on the ease of convenience. Rails is pretty much near the top. But when you want, you know, the fact that Django is, I don't know, 75%, 80% of the way there, but lets you customize it with experience, you appreciate that trade-off, I think. But it's a little bit of a bump when you're just starting out. It's not all magic.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. Like, Rails is definitely easier from like step one. But I think Django's strength come, like, you know, like, Eventbrite still runs Django. We've replaced like half of it in various pieces, right? Like, we run a different like user authentication framework and cookie system, but like, we still have the old CSRF system, right? We run a different cache layer, but we still run things like the ORM pretty much untouched. So that's kind of part of the way, like, part of the value I see in Django itself.
Yeah. Well, I think it's what Instagram swapped out the ORM, because I was wondering, I know they have, Facebook has its own solution. If that's, if you can speak broadly, is that, like, where are the pain points that, to the extent these couple sites that are at massive scale that use Django, where does Django kind of break down at super scale? Or is it really just specific on the needs of the project?
So I think I can speak to Eventbrite more than Instagram, though I do know they do run Facebook Graph as their data store rather than the ORM. But like, one of the problems we face at Eventbrite is that running at scale means having like, it's more a problem of engineering teams, right? Like, you can't have all the teams running on one big project. It's much easier to have them working on like separate, for a better word, let's say microservices, but they're not micro, they're sort of like medium-sized services. But what that means is, like, you now have this whole like service call and routing problem you didn't have before. And crucially for async, you have this thing where like you're gonna, your like main view or template logic is gonna call like four or five other things to service different parts of the page and wait for them all and come back. If you wait for those all serially, you're gonna be waiting a lot longer than if you call them all in parallel and get the results in parallel and put them all on the page. Because those things act independently. I think that's one of the things of Django, like at least I've seen talking to other big sites too, is that like making sure it can split up more and more and become more independent like that.
Channels version two, I know Carlton, you mentioned that maybe there was more to unpack there about what that was
Okay, so one thing, you know, that's interesting is what was actually wrong with Channels 1? Because lots of people took Channels 1, they built good sites, they were using it very well, and yet you weren't happy, and other people using it at scale perhaps weren't happy. So what was the issue with Channels 1? If you could explain that, I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and also I want to explain, like, I do not make the choice to go back for something incompatible lightly too, right? So that's like, if I make a big jump like that, it's because there's a good reason. And in this case, it's architectural. Channels 1 was written in an architecture where you had a server that received WebSockets and HTTP requests. You had a separate server that ran Django and the functions. And both of those talked to a central bus, which was called the channel layer, which is basically Redis for most installs. This is an interesting architecture in theory. And in theory, it scales really well. But in practice, it doesn't. In particular, it's much more fragile. And you're adding in another point of failure to the webflow. Like you've gone from running a single server process to running two different processes and also a communication layer between them. And in the end, like I just couldn't overcome the difficulty of doing all of that. Like deploying it was massively confusing. And in many ways, the reason we did that was because Channels 1, its goal was to work with the LTS at the time, which supported Python 2, which meant we couldn't use async.io. Channels 2 is a re-examining of the same problem that Channels 1 was a solution to, but with the different constraint of you can support 3.5 and up. And like given those two different constraints, you end up with two different designs. But like to support Python 2, you can't have asynchronous code. You have to run a different process. Like Redis was your asynchronous scheduler, basically. That's how it worked. Whereas with Channels 2, we're like, well, we have async.io now. We can do this internally in Python. And sure, there are a few issues with async.io. It's not totally perfect, but having it in process is way easier. And having the deploy be run it like WSGI is also a lot easier to convince people of, like, hey, like you just run a server and pass an application object like you used to, rather than running a weird Redis cluster that you can't shard properly and all that jazz.
Yeah, okay. Right, and because you as well, like deploying Django is hard enough for your average project.
Right.
Without making it extra hard by having this whole DevOps layer.
Yeah, and not to mention, like, you couldn't use Redis cluster because of the way we use Redis, like it had blocking calls. And so it has to have its own sharding implementation that ran on top of Redis that sharded basically. I'm very impressed it worked as well as it did in production. I'm very happy that it did, but it just wasn't conducive to long-term maintenance. And crucially, it's not a pattern we could have taken Django itself into. Like we could never make Django look like that.
Okay.
So you mentioned a couple of times dealing with burnout in your career, which makes sense given how busy you are. I'm curious how do you tell that you're burned out, and then what sort of techniques have worked for you? Because I think this is something that hits almost everyone. Maybe not Simon. When we interviewed Simon, I remember saying, like, you're the un-burnout engineer. Like, he's so enthusiastic. But for everyone else and for yourself, how have you spotted it? And then what works, or is it beyond just taking a break from all the extra work that you're doing? Yeah.
So I'll preface this by saying, like, burnout is deeply personal. And I think, like, what works for me doesn't work for other people, right? But, like, with that caveat in place, like,
yeah,
my personal signs are generally a lack of enthusiasm, mostly for doing anything, right? It's almost like apathy. So, like, I go from the two of you who are here can see behind me on the video that I have, like, there's a sewing machine, there's a 3D printer behind me. You can't even see the other. Like, I do a lot of making in my spare time, right? Like, when those hobbies start suffering is when I know I'm suffering from burnout. It's when I'm like my making and 3D printing and fabrication and like my other like crazy art projects suffer. That's when I know, like, overall I'm being burnt out. And then the way I found to do that is to just step back. And I've been more forceful with myself over time. I used to be like, oh, if I step back, like, I feel guilty, like the community depends on me. Like, everyone's felt that in a different way, be it like your company or your spouse or anyone depends on you. And in the end, like, I found that, like, just, you know, like with Channels 2 at the start of the year, I was like, like, I have realized I'm burnt out. I'm giving myself, I get a month, right? There's a month to try and find a handover period. And Colton very thankfully stepped in to help at that point. But I was like, you know, it's better to take this project and say, like, it is officially done than to try and keep pushing through the burnout. Because, like, it's a big problem I have with documentation sometimes too, is like, it's much more to say, like, this, like, be honest, right? This is not maintained. It's much better than saying, like, oh, this has the look of being maintained, but it's not actually under the hood. And that's very different.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a massive, the expectation thing that you mentioned just there is absolutely true, especially contributing to open source. And there's kind of like this, people get this expectation that they have to contribute, that they have to triage that extra ticket, that they have to, it's like, no, you're volunteering. Like, and you, much more important is you say no and that you take the time for yourself so that you enjoy contributing. And, you know, if you can't do that, step away. Absolutely.
And I also want to talk to something that's not obvious to people. Like, being an open source maintainer is particularly difficult because all you ever get are bugs. The only feedback you ever see as a maintainer are the problems people have. Like I, for like 7-8 years of South, for all of migrations and for most of channels, like, I only ever saw people going, it doesn't work for me, it's ruined my life. Like, I never, like, the only time I ever got positive feedback was basically at conferences. People come like, oh yeah, we're using your thing in a production to serve like $3 million. I was like, what? But like, that's the only time you ever hear that stuff. Like, so like, I encourage you, like, if you're listening and you and like, there's an open source project you use that you think might be in this problem, like, an email to the creator or maintainers saying thank you is always welcome. Like, I get a couple of those every month and they're always welcome. Like, just having people reach out and go like, your work is amazing, thank you very much. Like, it honestly, like, those are what keep me going. Like, that it's, you know, otherwise you just see like everyone trying to do weird things with databases and not succeeding. And it just, it feels like a huge load, right? Like, having that empathy for everyone is difficult.
Well, I remember there was a permissions mix in, was it the login permissions mix in that, someone brought to my attention 6 months ago, and I looked at the ticket and found the person who had worked on it and shot them a quick email. And yeah, they responded as if they'd never gotten an email of thanks in their life about it. So it's certainly helpful. And yeah, even for me, like, in a way, books are a form of open source. Like, numbers don't mean anything. It's the personal emails, which aren't that many, that make it meaningful and push through the sort of the negative, like, yeah, this is broken kind of stuff, which does get tiring.
Yeah, and it's just a general thing in life. Like when we work in a volunteer community, it's important to respect each other and make sure, like, each I try and make sure that I thank everyone in person, whoever I can, who does work that helps me out. And I think just, you know, if we just have more of that going forward, and like, the Django community is already one of the best communities I've ever been in for open source, right? Like, I joke that sometimes I stick around for the people, but it's kind of half true, right? Like, the group of people around Django, some of the nicest, kindest, and best people I've ever like had the pleasure of interacting with and working with and supporting and just being around. And that's a huge part of it.
Also, as well, there's a culture where correct behavior is expected, and the code of conduct and everything that's done around that is so important. And it just inculcates, like, once it started, like, when I first turned up to a Django event, I was like, wow, blown away. I've been using Django for 10 years. I'd never been to an event. And I came and I was like, oh, wow, this is what I've been missing. And it was just already there. And in contrast to other environments where perhaps not, it's like, it's really noticeable.
There's a reason that, like, I used to fly. I've been to every DjangoCon Europe and every DjangoCon US for a reason, right? It's not just because I like going to different random states in the US. It's also because, like, there are people there who are very, like, I see them twice a year, but I see them some of my best friends, right? That's kind of the way Django works.
I remember first and only DjangoCon, I experienced that. And but most people can't go to DjangoCon yet use Django. So that was really, this podcast came about in part to open up people to the broader community and the people like yourself who have these amazingly outsized roles. Yet, you know, I would say the majority of people using Django don't know who you are. And more of them should. So,
but also I'm fine with that, right? Like, one of the things, like, maybe one of the things
you're still a programmer.
We all want to go off in our cave and do our thing, but, you know, when we pop our head up every once in a while, it's nice to
Yeah, one of the weirdest experiences for me was Gen Con 2009-2010. Like what second or third one? Someone came up to me and went, "Oh, are you Andrew Godwin?" And I was like, "Yes." So I know that. Oh no, I just know you from online. Like that was the turn of like people knowing who I was without me knowing them, and it's honestly a very strange experience. I've got much more used to it now, and like I try and meet new people every Django Con and try and push beyond my admittedly like very difficult like introvert boundaries to meet new people. But at the same time, like, yeah, there's a lot of people that like Django Con is by its very nature has to be an exclusive event, right? Not everyone can travel, not everyone is in the right country or can get visas or whatever. And so I think it's also important that we make sure Django is supportive in other ways too. And like we have a good community online and, you know, in different mediums like that.
Well, Carlton was noticed someone by his voice alone, right? At one of the sprints at Django Con Europe. So, they're like, "Oh, wait, who are you? Oh, you're that podcast person, right?"
Yeah, I was talking through an issue with someone. I'm sort of knelt down next to them with they're at their laptop and all of a sudden they stop and they're like, "Do you do that podcast?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, because I'm just talking in their ear." Like, okay.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, one thing with the Django community, from where I sit, because I think I sort of sit hopefully maybe near the beginning of the tunnel and you guys are both at the, you know, very Mount Everest of it, is there's so many people learning Django for the first time who it's their first web framework.
Yeah.
Or I mean, just the variety of people I interact with is unbelievable. It's, you know, it's undergrads doing computer science. I mean, just last week it was multiple tenured Ivy League professors in, you know, economics or some other profession who for whatever reason want to learn web stuff, and they're, you know, one of them is like on track for, I looked him up, on track for like Nobel Prize in economics. And he was stuck on chapter 3 of my book with Heroku. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I got stuck on it too, like a lot of people do, but it's both this great equalizer. And also people are just using, you know, Django and web as a piece of whatever they're already doing, because they see that to be knowledgeable in the modern world, it's such a benefit. And so it's, I just see all this crazy upside to Django as being one of, if not the default entryways to web development for people, you know. So I think I would bet the Django will be way bigger than it is now in a couple years, because all those points are going the right direction, I guess. I mean, I met you for the first time at PyCon. I mean, PyCon is really not about Django, and yet it's massive.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think one of the things I think the Django contributors over the years have been good at is not forgetting beginners, right? Like, it's very easy to fall into the thing like, oh, like we've all been working on this for like 5-10 years, we're now all experts, we should solve the expert problems. And like, one of the things I try not to lose perspective on is like the beginner view. Like, what does it mean to sit down for the first time, use this thing, and try and understand like the web is still revolutionary, right? Like, we need to keep empower people in that way. Like, what is it to sit down and understand this and like not know how anything this works? Like, I don't want people to know what async is until like at least, you know, chapter 9 of any potential book, right? Like, they should not have to care about it.
I get reminded weekly, yeah, but what are these sticking points? I mean, so that professor, it was the structure. He was using start project and he didn't include the period.
Mm.
You know, even though I specifically said 3 times you need to include the period, even though I had the source code, you know, because, you know, so it's, so I'm very aware of that thing. And even actually last week, on Friday, I got stuck on a no reverse match error. And I was having an existential crisis over it, because I'm just, how much time have I spent on this? I can't believe I'm having this issue. But, you know, I asked Carlton, Jose Padilla, a whole bunch of people. And, you know, it wasn't like everyone immediately saw it, even among, you know, this like murderer's row of Django people. So programming is very humanizing like that.
Totally, yeah. And it's just async doubly so, because like I often struggle to think about, like, I was taught like asynchronous like proof theory university, which is like, it's one of the very few things I've come back to go, actually that was useful, and I have used it again. But like, it's so, like, I regularly sit down, just sit there, like lie on my bed with like a drink of like iced tea or something, going like, what is this problem? How do we solve it? And just like thinking it through. Like, it's not easy. And I don't want to, like, again, if you want to remove the guardrail and jump into it, we should let you. But I also think we should protect you from it unless you really want that.
Yeah. One thing you've talked about with the async proposal is to keep sync views as the default way of doing it, because most times it's easy and that's the one you want to walk into. And then when you want to opt into async, then it's there, not not suddenly we've got a Node.js like web framework replacing Django. It's not
right.
It's not going to be like that.
Like one of the things you learn when you write async code is async code is just harder. Like it's like you've got more to think about. There's more to have in your brain at once. And I honestly will find any excuse to write synchronous code I can, because like synchronicity and the GIL and everything, sure, it's slower, but it makes it so much easier to think about and understand. And like, I value that sometimes. Like if the code's not performance critical, that's great. And like, that's...
And most times.
Yeah, most code times isn't. Exactly, not. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for people listening, what are some good steps to get involved and learn more? We're going to link to your proposal. What would you say if someone says, well, I know Django, but async is still new to me, in terms of, well, here's how you learn more, and then here are maybe some areas that could use help on.
So I unfortunately have not yet found a good async tutorial, which means I probably have to either write one or get somebody else to write one. But there are some...
For Python, or you mean for Python?
For Python, or even just the general concept of what it means to have... So like Python's version of async is called cooperative asynchronous programming, which is similar to some other languages, but like, for example, Go is not the same, right? Go is not quite, it's similar, but not exactly the same. It's like, just like interesting, like how do you even think about the problem? How do you reason about it? Like, that's what's missing. At the same time, it's Python. So I suggest you just like find a project, just hack on it. Like, just make a little thing that fetches URLs in parallel. Like, the classic example is you want to fetch like 10 URLs in parallel, and you can do that in like 5 lines of asynchronous Python. But like, do that and like just break it and try and work out why it breaks. Like that's my approach to stuff. And for Django async in general, it seems like DEP9, which is the big long document you referred to earlier, seems to have sort of settled down, and the feedback slowed down. So we're going to start pushing it through to the proposal process for the technical board. And once that's done, I'm going to start working on both a how to get involved sort of blog post or document, and also a funding one, because the funding is a big part for us. Look forward to those. I don't have them yet, unfortunately. I took a good...
Well, they may be out by the time we release this.
This is true, yes. But at time of recording, I just come back from 2 weeks of vacation and a week of PyCon before that. So those are not times when I get stuff done, should we say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. What about you, Carlton? Anything to add on that front?
So one thing you've mentioned a couple of times... Oh, well, on that front in particular, no. One thing you mentioned a couple of times is documentation. And I know you're really keen on writing good documentation. The channels docs are just phenomenal, to be honest. So
yeah.
Can you talk about your philosophy there and stuff? Because I think it's something that a lot of people could learn from, and I've learned from myself.
Yeah. I mean, the philosophy in some ways is self-inflicted, because I learned it when I was looking at my code from 3 years prior and going, what was I thinking? So I write documentation for myself in the future is the line I use, right? It's like, well, okay, like, and to me, documentation is not about how to use, it's about how to think, right? It's like, if you are approaching this project, here is the frame of mind, here is the way that as the author or as a maintainer, I approach this project, and like, that will by itself convey to you like how to approach this. Like the channels docs, for example, a good portion of them is concepts. It's like, here are the concepts, and here's a glossary of the words we use elsewhere, because that will get you so much further than me guiding you through it with like hand on hand. Because like, I could give you lines to run, but you wouldn't understand at the end. Like, my philosophy is always like, documentation is to teach and to inform you a thing exists and to show you how to approach it. And like, you do want like detailed instructions when you get there, but you have to have the other parts too. And that's kind of how I approach it.
I think that's well said, because I noticed when I think meta about things, the difference between documentation and tutorials, where people want tutorials, but you sort of need documentation. And I think when you say that, the channels docs in particular, why they're so great is because you also do sort of a tutorial on it.
Yeah.
You sort of meld those together, but that's a lot of work to do.
We need to do the same for async too, right? Like, there is presumably a part 5 or part 6 of the Django tutorial that is and now async with some jazz hands in it. But like, as I said, like you know, there is no good tutorial out there to learn how Python async works. I think it probably then falls to Django as a project to supply that. My hope also, like, you know, documentation is a crucial part of engineering. Like, if you haven't even talked about engineering, like, engineering is part programming, part documentation, part communication and collaboration. And like those parts are all pretty much equal in my experience. And people often put way too much emphasis on programming and not enough on the other two. Like written and verbal communication is incredibly important. And so a big part of this project is like, I want to bring on people that say like, hey, like we just need people to, who are good at explaining and understanding. And honestly, like beginners are the best at this. Like if you are a beginner or relatively new to Django or even to a concept, you are in the best position to explain what was difficult about it. Like your example earlier of the period, right? Like obviously you'd anticipated that one, but there are things I can't anticipate that like beginners go, oh, I found problem X really hard. I was like, oh, that never even occurred to me. And so like there's an amazing opportunity here for like beginners and people even like 1 or 2 years in, they still remember. Like I've forgotten what was hard about Python because I started in like Python 2.4 where people are going, oh, decorators are new and exciting. Like at this point, like, I'm on some ways a terrible teacher of Python. People come to me and go like, oh, how did you learn Python? And they're like, I can tell you, but it won't help. Because like all the things that were there in 2006 are totally irrelevant now. It's a different way of handling
They've gone.
Yeah.
Well, I find if you just ask, if you think something's simple, ask someone next to you to do it. Like install Python. Here's, you know, on a Windows machine. Go for it. Like, you're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, which that thankfully suddenly got a lot easier in the last month or two. But yeah, it's so many things like that where I want to like make sure that, again, like we talked about beginners earlier, right? Like beginners are a crucial part of Django's ecosystem. I've always wanted to make sure, and like so are big companies. I don't want to have us like captured by big companies, right? Enough people who work with Django and Python in general work at big companies. Like I want to occasionally forget about the big scale problems and come back to, I'm writing my blog, like how do I get that stuff working properly, right? Like I do still maintain my own Django Power blog, half for this reason. It is still on Django 1.10, I think, unfortunately, but it does use migrations at least, and like that's kind of my my test bed for like I'm just like a normal like contractor again. Like how do I handle this stuff? And that's a useful perspective to have, I think.
Yeah,
well, I think it's why. Oh, go on.
I was just going to say one of the beautiful things about async is that it's coming out of this need that is seen rather than, you know, Eventbrite has a specific need and you are filling that via open source. So in some ways that solves some problems in that it doesn't seem like you feel the burden of building something custom for Eventbrite or someone else for a specific company. It can be done in this, you know, community-based way, whereas many other features on other projects, you know, do have that, you know, a large company wants something custom and then you have trade-offs.
Yeah, a classic example, that's Kubernetes, right? Like Kubernetes is pretty much written how I would think about an enterprise level orchestrator, which means it's very hard to get into and you can't really run it on a single box. It's getting better, but like that's what I wanted to avoid. And part of channels one and channels two and like the years of research and talking to people has been working out like what is best for everyone, like talking to different people up and down the spectrum in different countries and different industries of like, hey, like what do you need, like what's useful for you? And I think like the culmination of that is like the async proposal is pretty much like it's the node of like here is the place where all those needs cross and like everyone can agree on this stuff. And I'm hoping like the general lack of people going, oh, this is a terrible idea is proof of that, right? Like everyone seems to go, oh yeah, no, we do need this. But also it's a very difficult thing. And like, yeah, like if it was just for Eventbrite, it'd be a very different solution to the problem. But that's not my goal here.
Carlton, what were you going to say before I cut you off?
I was going to say something about the previous conversation, but there's no point going back to it now. I think it was a minor agreeing with Andrew.
Okay. When I edit these podcasts, I often hear myself jumping over you, Carlton, so I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Didn't your mum tell you about that as well?
Yes, my parents remind me of many
that's
helpful things I can improve on.
That's all super. I think, okay, so Andrew,
is there anything else for people to get like in touch or what else do you want to promote? I mean, you have a lot of other projects as well, Andrew. What would you like to say? As we wrap this up,
I have enough other projects that I'm not going to promote any one of them. Like, if you're interested in like electronics and fabrication, like, you know, I have a YouTube channel with some stuff or on Twitter. But honestly, like, the thing I like, if you listen to this podcast, you're probably involved with Django. What I encourage you to do is like look out, like we'll get a post on the Django blog probably, but I'll tweet about it as well. Like look out for like us talking about like how to get involved, and like I really want to run async in a way that not only brings in new contributors, but also like is spread out properly. And like we spread the workload and we have everyone understanding and agreeing on how things work. So I'd love people to, like, even if it's just like copy editing documentation or writing some new tests, like there's so much work that we can do that can be paralyzed out that, you know, don't feel shy about stepping up. Don't feel like you're going to have the burden of the world coming down, crushing on you. Like it's not like that, at least not at first. And
yeah, so we can make the work async, right?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like, like I, above all else, like, please get involved. Like, not even with this, like maybe a local like Django Girls meetup or like Pie Ladies or other meetups. Like, open source takes volunteer work and it takes many volunteers to make it sustainable. So that's my call to action.
You're brilliant. And all I'd just add on to that is that as well, if you feel like you need help with that, reach out, because there are people in the community that will support you in contributing if you want to contribute.
Yeah, people are way nicer than you give them credit for, is my general advice. I've seen it time and time again, like especially in the Django and Python communities. I generally expect the best of people, and I'm usually rewarded, which says a lot.
Yeah, and if you're reaching out, you're validating how someone in a position of expertise spends their time. So
yeah,
regardless of the question, it's sort of validating and it's interesting because it provides that lens on, oh, I forgot that this was hard, or I forgot, you know, that makes sense that with your lens, this is how you think about it. So it's helpful as well to even someone who's an expert.
Totally. As I said, like, beginners have the best questions and often have the best answers. So reach out.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. As ever, people can find this episode on djangochat.com. We're on Twitter at chatdjango, and we'll have links to everything in the show notes that we talked about. So thanks again, Andrew, for making the time.
Super.
Thank you for having me on. It's been great.
All right. Bye.